Today comes from the book of Isaiah, the 60th chapter, verses 1 through 6. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look around. They will gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from far away, and your daughters shall be carried on their nurses' arms. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Our New Testament reading today is from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?" "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are not least among the cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too." After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. They opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. This is the word of the Lord. This week is Epiphany. By the way, the definition of Epiphany is a usually sudden manifestation or perception of the essential nature or meaning of something. Did you catch that? An epiphany is to usually suddenly grasp reality, what something is, what it means. The history of celebrating Epiphany as part of the Christian tradition is fascinating, actually. The Eastern Orthodox Church believed Christmas was 13 days after December 25, and in an attempt to reconcile and connect the Eastern and Western, or the Western Church, that's why we have 13 days of Christmas. That song comes along. There's 13 days from December 25 to, I think it's January 6th. Is that about that? Yeah, that's today. It's the 6th. Well, it depends, because Sunday we celebrate it. It's not always on the Sunday, but I think this year it is actually today. And so they called it Epiphany, which was celebrated as the day the wise men showed up. And of course, the text probably, the fact that Herod later kills everybody under two means it was most likely that the wise men showed up within about 2 years of Jesus being born, as opposed to, you know, the nativity scenes we all see with wise men and shepherds, and that number probably didn't happen. But it makes for a great nativity scene. But the concept of Epiphany, of stopping and remembering, and the church has articulated it as the day God's salvation, the Christ, was revealed to the Gentiles, as represented by the Magi. And a word on that. Magi, by the way, never, ever, ever simply means wise men or kings. The text also, how many of them were there? Really? What verse? Was that from? We don't know. There were three gifts, and we sing this song at the end of the service today that says, "We three kings." So there had to have been three. There's all these things about the Christmas story that we think we know that we might not. Epiphany. We don't know if there were three magi. The text just says magi came from the east. Magi, actually, in the Greek usage of the word, was very... these were royal astrologers, most likely, Zoroastrians, from Babylon. Now, if you, and you all know enough about Jewish history to know that anytime anybody comes from Babylon, what is this? Bad. Babylon is biblical code for bad. Nebuchadnezzar came from Babylon and conquered Israel and subjugated them to slavery for hundreds of years, 70 years. It was the Egyptians who had them for 400. Babylon is kind of code for this kingdom that does not respect God, that is an antithesis to God's kingdom. And Babylon is horrible and evil, and you kind of wanted to come out of Babylon, not have anything to do with it. So when Matthew takes this text and starts... this is his very first, I mean, the verse right before Matthew chapter 2 is the only people who know about Jesus coming are Joseph and Mary. That's it. And the very first people God chooses to reveal Messiah coming to be part of us here on earth too is a group of pagan astrologers from Babylon. That'll preach, right? Of all the people we'd least expect God to reveal himself to, these guys would probably be on the list. This is unexpected, incredibly unexpected, that God would show himself to these people from this place is amazing. It's also kind of helpful to get a little background to what's going on in Jerusalem and Judea at this time. Herod, it says, there's the first line, Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. Herod is an amazingly fascinating person. History, after his death, has kind of given him the epithet Herod the Great, which I would like to dispute. He was great because he did lots of things. He built the temple, of course. The second temple was constructed by Herod. He built all sorts of fortresses, Masada, several other places. He constructed the harbor in Caesarea. He did a bunch of large building projects. Herod, incidentally, was born in Idumea, or he was an Edomite. He was not a Jew, but he was raised as a Jew, and he was serving the Hyrcanus dynasty, or the Hyrcanian kings before him. There was an argument between them and some other people, and Herod went to Rome to petition Caesar on behalf of John Hyrcanus. While there, he was unexpectedly, by Caesar, declared king of the Jews. And so he comes back and fights a war to regain his kingdom from the Hyrcanians. He is, incidentally, at the time, married to one of their daughters, Doris. He conquers Jerusalem and Judea. He owns the kingdom he was declared king of by Caesar. And then, of course, needs to consolidate his power. He's an Edomite. He is not a Jew. So to be king of the Jews and not be a Jew is a problem. How do you fix it? The way royal dynasties always do, right? I'm going to marry somebody who actually does have royal blood. So he marries Mariamne. Her name is Miriam. In Greek, it's the exact same as Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Miriam, Moses' sister. This name is loaded. It has all sorts of incredible... this explains actually a bunch of the story of the angel coming to Mary and saying, your son's going to be powerful and take over the kingdom. And Mariamne, Herod's wife, shortly before this is the recent history. So Herod marries Mariamne, who is a descendant of King David. So he marries, of course, royal blood after he's married to Doris, right? So this is his second, third, fourth, who knows, later wife. And he marries her in order to gain legitimacy in Judea. And they have a little bit of a contentious relationship. She does not just go along with everything Herod says. So Herod starts kind of isolating her a little bit. By the way, at some point in here, he also banishes Doris and his children by Doris into exile, and then kills his sons that she had because they might be a threat to the throne. Somewhere in here, he also starts killing some of the sons of his other wives because at this point, he wants Mariamne's children to be the legitimate heirs to his throne, and only them. He later, of course, has Mariamne executed. He kills his own mother when she starts arguing about what he's doing. Herod the Great. This guy's fantastic. He is an absolute tyrant with an absolute grip on power. He is making sure he has this personal bodyguard of 2,000 soldiers there's Celtics, there's Thracians, there's some Germanic soldiers that are mentioned in there. Josephus actually tells us all sorts of stuff about Herod the Great, and that's where we learn most of this from. And Herod had an incredible grip on power. He was, what was the title? King of the Jews. Anyone, including his own family, who posed even a remote threat to his kingdom got killed fast. Of course, on the other side of things, he was building an empire, right? He made the church as it was, right? Temple was the center of Jewish religious life. Herod rebuilt the temple. He was doing, if you're a Jewish religious person, what do you think about Herod? I mean, look, he made temple. How wonderful. How great, as the disciples said, right? Jesus, look at these incredible stones. It's amazing. Look at this building. Herod wanted a capital worthy of his glory. He had some side notes for, or some personal reasons for doing this. But this is what we find this story happening in. Jesus is born in Bethlehem of Judea during the reign of this brutal dictator. And about that time, some magi from the east, from Babylon, come to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews?" It means something a little different now, doesn't it? Herod's not out here with the party poppers and celebrating. If there is a newborn king of the Jews, Herod is immediately threatened by this, right? I mean, that's what the text actually says. King Herod was deeply disturbed. And we're like, huh, that's weird. Well, whatever. No, this is something threatening to the system, to the power, the economics, all of this. The whole priestly thing is deeply enmeshed with this too. It's Herod's mother-in-law, Alexandra, from Doris, I believe, is petitioning Cleopatra, Mark Antony's wife, to have Aristobulus, her other son, made high priest so that their family can maintain some prestige and power. Herod finds out about this, and guess what he has done to Aristobulus? Like everybody else, gets him killed. But there's this record of all this. So the priesthood is actually very politically in play as a part of this whole debate. It is the Jewish life. And of course, some of the Jewish sects see this and criticize Herod pretty heavily. The Pharisees were massive critics of Herod. They didn't think he was following Jewish sentimentalities or customs and argued with him, but not too loudly, because if you argued with Herod loudly or at all, you quickly lost your head. Exactly. You didn't live long to do that. He suppressed dissent ruthlessly. Herod is disturbed by this. He calls the priests together, who are kind of on his side as well, and is trying to figure out how big this threat actually is. And then, you know, kind of plays duplicitously with the Magi and tells them, you know, go find him and let me know so I can go worship him too. Right. Totally. Yeah. We're pretty good at human beings at seeing through people's BS, right? We actually are very, very attuned to all sorts of nonverbal cues. I mean, the experts say 93% of communication is nonverbal. And you can say something to somebody acting kind, but if that's not what you actually feel, you just know, right? You're like, that person, what do they do? Nothing. Yeah. I kind of think the Magi had a clue here. They're probably wise men, and wise people are going to figure this out, and they do. They very much disobey the most powerful man in Judea in this story, which is some really cool courage, too. Like, when we do not have to follow tyrants and despots. They can tell us what to do. We don't have to follow it. Cool side note. So they come to see Jesus, and they come, and of course, they come in and bow down. And there's this beautiful part of this story, right, is this them following the light. Especially, we talked about it last week in John 1, that John uses the metaphor of light coming into the darkness. And Matthew here as well is using that same illustration of a star of light that these wise men are following. And that this light leads them to discover Jesus, Christ, the Messiah, God's presence here on earth. That by following this light, they do receive epiphany, this enlightenment, this revelation of who God is and what that means. They get to have a relationship and an encounter with Jesus. They come and give Jesus their gifts, valuable gifts, gold, frankincense, myrrh, these precious things that they offer and give to the God of the universe, which is an amazing, amazing construct when you think about even that, right? Psalm says, it records God as saying, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. Right? Like, I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. If I needed something, I'm not going to call you, because he's God. But they're in this position as God comes down to earth and becomes human to actually be able to give to God. That's amazing. There's also some profoundness in that God is seeking to use and involve or to allow us to give of ourselves, our gifts, our talents, our presence in this place, and that actually contributes in amazing ways to what God is trying to do here. It's probably that gold, frankincense, and myrrh that allow Joseph and Mary to be able to have the resources to flee Herod and to escape to Egypt. They are very much participating in the story. The story becomes what it is because of what they give from themselves. But they follow the light. And of course, this is in great contrast. The two main characters in this chapter, this story right here, are the wise men and Herod. And Herod has his kingdom. How does he perceive the coming of God into this world and into this place? It's a threat, right? As opposed to the Magi who perceived the coming of God into this world and this place as this incredible opportunity, as a blessing, something that they are willing. Herod is, of course, all about, I forgot to tell you about this, but of course, to do all of these building projects, what's that take? Taxes. Money. Herod is very much about getting all of the resources, all of the money he can from people. His taxation system was incredibly oppressive in order to do that. Not that there weren't good things that came of it, but it was bad. He is about getting the money. The text very much is signifying the irony of these wise men coming, and instead of about getting, they are about giving. They are generously offering their resources to Jesus as opposed to trying to take. There could not be two more contrasting strategies of how to deal with life, of what the meaning of all of this reality is, right? This is why epiphany is such a good word for this story. for what it means, because this is very much a story about this world, about our lives, about what the significance going on underneath all of the little details is. Is this about us building our kingdoms? Or is this about us offering what we have been given to God and the people around us? I love the text from Isaiah. Matthew very much has this text in mind, right? There's gold, frankincense, and myrrh mentioned. There's kings from around the world coming and worshiping God mentioned. But this is how it starts. Arise, Jerusalem, let your light shine for all to see. For the glory of the Lord rises to shine on you. What a beautiful statement. God's light is rising on you, in you, through you. But like the wise men and Herod, we very much have a choice of how we respond to this light. Do we see this light of Jesus coming into our world as an incredible blessing, as illumination, as revealing what matters most? Or we'd see this as a threat to our kingdoms, a threat to our power or prominence. We enter into the story as well. We too either get to receive epiphany, this incredible realization and this grasp of reality, this illuminating discovery, this profound realization of reality and what it means, this manifestation of Christ. Are we going to follow the light? Are we going to run from it? Are we going to seek to snuff it out? Awesome truth to this story as well. Does snuffing it out work? No. Not a very effective long-run strategy. And that's incredibly hopeful, right? Isaiah says that too. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness cannot overwhelm it. Darkness is black as the night covers the nations on the earth, but the glory of the Lord rises and appears over you. The darkness cannot snuff out the light. In the end, and that's what we see, all the nations will come to your light. That's the choice I want to make. That's the choice I hope each of us make. Because the truth of Jesus becoming one of us is that the light is for us, not against us. This is what we will participate in communion, that God Himself is given to us, literally. We come as and can offer our gifts, our time, our talent, our treasure to God, but of course God in the process is offering far more to us. I hope this week, this year, you have some profound epiphanies, some realizations of just how much God is for you. Some realizations of where the light is leading in your life, where it is calling you to follow, and that you, like those wise men, have the wisdom, the courage, and the love to follow. Amen. Will you sing with me?